It's 4 degrees in Colstrip, Montana. Robin Sterrett, a mechanical engineer who's lived in Colstrip 30 years, he's showing me around, talking about the good old days.
This was just open country back then, where the buffalo roam. So we got fog today, we can barely see the plants here. But
on the edge of town, 4 smokestacks rise up higher than the surrounding hills. They're the tallest man-made structures in the state.
Oh yeah, they're just sort of looming behind the fog.
A day like today, everybody's got their heat on.
There's only one reason this little town is out here on the Scrubgrass Prairie, in the southeast corner of Montana. This ground holds a lot of coal. Nearly every family here relies on coal jobs, either at the mine on one end of town or at the power plant that burns the coal from the mine on the other end of town. These are good jobs, the kind of blue-collar, union jobs that have disappeared from small towns all over the United States. High-paying, good benefits, clock-in until retirement jobs.
Take a look. Everybody's got a nice car and everything.
Yeah.
You know, they got a boat.
And it's true. This is a prosperous place. In fact, the median household here brings in almost $90,000 a year. A lot more than almost anywhere else in Montana. But in 2016, Colstrip received bad news.
Big news today on Montana's coal-fired Colstrip power plants. Owners of the 4 plants have agreed to close Colstrip plants.
Puget Sound Energy will shut down 2 of its 4 units in Colstrip.
The very existence of an entire town right here in Montana, right down the road, is being threatened.
We're suddenly like, wow, am I going to have to leave? Or is my family going to have to start over? You never know. If the times get bad enough, they might have to let everybody go. Like, who knows what could happen?
That's Lori Shaw. She grew up here in Colstrip and serves on city council. Her husband works as an accountant at the mine.
Absolutely, I'm afraid. Yeah, I'm afraid every day.
At this point, it's hard to know if there's a Colstrip without coal. The town is looking for other employers to come in and fill the space left by the plant closure. But when you're 80 miles from the closest population center, you have few options.
Now, the thing is, are you going to find jobs that pay as well as what's over there at the power plant?
I mean, there's nothing else here.
27-year-old Josh Sue makes good money as a welder mechanic at the mine.
I chose it because it's basically because it was close to home and I could be home every night, you know?
Home for Josh is 15 miles south of Colstrip, on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. The biggest town on the reservation is called Lame Deer. Josh is a member of the Cheyenne tribe. Life is really different in Lame Deer than it is in Colstrip. It's poorer, by a lot. The unemployment numbers are huge there, as high as 75% depending on who you ask. About 100 Cheyennes work at the mine or the plant right now, and more work service jobs that depend on the coal industry, like the hotel or the gas station. And here's the thing, just like folks in Colstrip, many on the reservation don't want to see the plant close either.
I love it. I love working out here.
But there is a difference. When the plant closes, the town of Colstrip will be hit hard. Harder, actually, than the reservation, since a higher proportion of families rely directly on coal jobs. But for Cheyennes like Josh, leaving the area to chase a job has a different kind of gravity. The reservation is not just where his family lives or where he grew up. It's the last piece of ground in the world belonging to the Northern Cheyenne.
You know, our people sacrificed a lot to get the land that we have.
This is Dennis Limberhand. He's an elder.
Born and raised in Lame Deer, Montana, my Cheyenne.
Dennis says the history of the Northern Cheyennes tells you that they always fought for what they thought was right. The most famous example was the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876. The Cheyennes call it the Battle of Greasy Grass. That's when the Cheyennes fought alongside the Lakota Sioux to defeat General Custer. It was a huge victory, but the aftermath was brutal. The U.S. Army changed tactics and threw everything they had at the resisting tribes, and the Cheyennes were forced to move down to Indian Territory in present-day Oklahoma. The conditions there were terrible. There wasn't enough food, and malaria ripped through the tribe. The people were starving, and so leaders Dull Knife and Little Wolf decided to escape. To them, staying was a death sentence.
They walked all the way back from Oklahoma. Dull Knife band were captured at Fort Robinson, you know, and people, women and children were killed because they didn't want to go back. They wanted to go home. And we just got a small piece of land, 450,000 acres or so. And that's precious land for the Cheyennes.
This story might seem like long ago history, but for Dennis, it's not distant. He grew up knowing people who had walked with Dull Knife's band. So the Cheyennes will fight to keep control of that little piece of land and the culture they've maintained there, just like they've done over and over. This story is about one of those times. Dennis is 70 now. He pulls his gray hair back into a braid and wears big belt buckles. He also has a really great mustache.
I wear a black cowboy hat most of the time, and I love it.
Back in 1968, when he was 21 years old, Dennis got in a riding accident.
Some people say, did you fall off your horse? Hell no, I got bucked off, you know? Hell of a difference.
He had some nasty injuries and spent 6 months in a body cast. Dennis was not the kind of guy to feel sorry for himself.
That's the reason I ran for tribal council, as I recall. I wasn't able to do any physical labor, so.
Dennis became the youngest person elected to the Northern Cheyenne Tribal Council. The tribal council is the heart of the Northern Cheyenne Nation's government.
It wasn't a paid position, but if you were interested in helping the people, well, you ran.
Northern Cheyenne country is epic. With rusty red dirt hillsides and sandstone formations, blue creeks, the muddy green Tongue River, and big blue sky. And it's remote, even more so back when Dennis was growing up in the 50s and the 60s.
We were probably 20, 30 years behind the curve. The old ladies wore blankets then, the shawls, you know. And the old men were still sitting in front of the store on a bench, you know, and talked and told stories. And it's just, to me, it was a good old days, you know.
Like the other kids on the reservation, Dennis learned early on about the history of his tribe, that the Cheyennes were almost wiped out. From the arrival of the first Europeans, they were constantly removed from one place to another against their will. The reservation system was established, and then a lot of reservation land ended up owned or controlled by non-Indians. Then, after World War II, the nation's economy was exploding, and giant multinational energy firms were gobbling up fossil fuels wherever they could find them.
There was a car or a truck for every three persons, almost 50 million motor vehicles.
And even though reservation land only covered about 2% of the United States, some estimated that reservations held as much as a quarter of the U.S.'s fossil fuel deposits. Of course, the companies saw this as an opportunity to tap into huge reserves cheaply. And many American Indian communities, including the Northern Cheyenne, saw energy as a way out of poverty. Before Dennis joined, the tribal council went looking for developers for their coal. They were hoping for a few mines and the jobs that came with the mines.
Their intentions were good. They wanted to create some revenue for the tribe. They wanted jobs. They wanted, what everybody else wants.
So the council signed off on a series of agreements with big coal companies in the late 60s and early 70s. Those deals were negotiated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or the BIA. Now, the BIA is a United States federal government agency, like the National Labor Relations Board, or NASA. It's important to note that throughout its history, the BIA has more often worked in favor of the U.S. government than in favor of the tribes. So these BIA officials, negotiating with the coal companies, they were low-level bureaucrats who had no experience with this kind of thing.
the largest deal these guys probably negotiated was, you know, the purchase of their $150,000 house at some point.
Historian James Allison wrote a book about Native American tribes during this era of energy development.
And here they are basically trying to do deals with the world's largest coal company to access, you know, millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars of coal.
Predictably, there wasn't much of a negotiation. The BIA signed a deal that vastly favored the energy company, Peabody Coal. Dennis remembers it this way.
I guess you could say that the coal companies just, you know, wrote their own leases and contracts, and the BIA rubber stamped them, you know?
These agreements basically rented tracts of reservation land to coal companies. The coal companies came in, surveyed the land, and began to draw up plans. One of the companies, Consolidation Coal, came up with a plan to cash in on the agreement they had with the tribe on an unexpectedly huge scale. They wanted to build four new power plants. Huge swaths of reservation land would be dug up for mines, and the forests and valleys would be transformed into an industrial city. The project was so huge that the company said they would need a new reservation town of 30,000 people to support the project. And with only 3,000 Cheyennes living on the reservation, the new town would be made up of outsiders. But as news of the proposal spread across the reservation, something had changed. Regular tribal members began to speak up. They were worried about what development on this scale could mean.
Hell, we'd be, you know, wiped out in a short time.
What do you mean, wiped out?
Well, we'd have been outnumbered, you know, we'd been overwhelmed. People would be displaced, you know, tradition, land, everything, disappear, yeah.
I want to pause here and say, it's really important to understand what it means to say the Cheyenne and other Indian tribes are sovereign nations. The Cheyennes' relationship to the reservation goes beyond just control. They have a legal and political right to self-government. Think of it this way. Cheyennes are dual citizens, citizens of their tribal nation in addition to the United States. So they absolutely call the shots, not the U.S. government or the BIA. So when the tribal council learned about the plan to build a city on their land, they had to act. They saw it as a threat to their nation's sovereignty. So the council made a move that hit the national press and echoed throughout Indian country. They unanimously voted to cancel all of the agreements. It was 1973.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cavett!
Marlon Brando appeared on the Dick Cavett Show.
I had several distressed phone calls a few months back saying you must come out to Lame Deer. The Cheyenne Reservation is threatened with disaster.
Marlon Brando had brought a special guest, Dennis.
Is it true that something like half the reservation has been given away?
Well, not exactly given away. About 55% of our reservation is under coal company control.
Coal company.
That prompted our tribal council into taking action against the United States government. Mm-hmm. We asked the Bureau of Indian Affairs to declare all permits and leases null and void.
It's hard to overstate how crazy this sounded to non-Indians in Montana and beyond, especially in the 70s. The Northern Cheyenne were turning down $250 million deal. American Indians as a whole were the most impoverished group in the country. From where the average non-Indian stood, the Cheyennes were sitting on a gold mine. Plus,
11 Arab countries cut off all oil shipments to the United States.
We are heading toward the most acute shortages of energy since World War II.
And that creates a real backlash among, non-Indian Americans that are like basically see American Indians as disloyal to the country at that point.
That's the historian James Allison again. For a lot of Montanans, leaving the coal in the ground wasn't just crazy, it was unpatriotic.
They've got very good reasons to want to control the development. They do view development that they can't control as a threat to their tribal survival.
We want to control our own destiny. We don't want, you know, somebody to talk us into something we don't want. We sacrifice too much for that.
In Montana, the strip miners have another problem. The Interior Department has canceled mining leases on the Cheyenne Indian Reservation there.
And this is really the first successful overturning of a energy deal put together by the federal government and an energy company by a tribal government.
They had won this round and had seized control of billions of dollars buried under their land.
And, I mean, importantly, they want to survive. This tiny tribe that most people were not familiar with, their ability to void coal leases held by, you know, some of the world's largest energy producers set us up for a situation in which tribes could suddenly control the development of their resources, right? So this is the watershed moment.
It was a moment that didn't go ignored in Indian country. In fact, in the years after, tribes around the country would follow the Cheyennes' example and stand up to energy developers on the same basis. K. Ross Toole, a Montana historian, called the Northern Cheyenne the most important tribe in this country. The trick now was to figure out how far they could leverage their newfound control.
Cheyennes have been in a lot of tough fights, you know. Heck, we's ready.
The same year Dennis goes on the Dick Cavett Show, the owners of Colstrip's power plant applied for approval to expand their operation. The company, Montana Power, was a local utility. They wanted to build two units on their power plant and triple the output, a $1.4 billion project. The Cheyenne Tribal Council had just exerted their control over industry inside reservation borders, but this project lay just beyond that boundary.
So it's not on the reservation, right? So the tribe can't shut it down in the ways it could cancel its leases for mining on the reservation. So the tribe has to get creative.
The Clean Air Act was still fairly new in 1976. It set up a classification system for the air. Under the law, there are three designations: Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3. Class 1 is the best, most pristine air. Think Glacier National Park. Class 3 is the worst you can get, the air in designated industrial zones. Class 2 is everything else in between. So all of southeastern Montana was Class 2, which meant that by law, some pollution was allowed.
The Northern Cheyenne look at this law and they said, well, we know how to stop the Colstrip expansion.
We applied for Class 1 air and were granted Class 1 air.
On the tribal stationery the council used to file the request, pictures of Dull Knife and Little Wolf, the two chiefs who walked all the way back from Oklahoma, and an inscription that reads, "Out of defeat and exile, they led us back to Montana and won our Cheyenne home, which we will keep forever." This move forced Montana Power to stop construction and re-engineer the whole project. About 100 workers were laid off, a big hit in such a small community.
We took a beating over that because, you know, we were costing people jobs and we was holding up progress. You know, it's the same old. Circle the wagons, you know. Damn Cheyennes are raising hell again.
And things got pretty nasty. It was 1976, and the country was coming off a recession. The plant expansion was to be a major source of jobs in the region. Tension between the Cheyennes and mostly white coal development supporters had been simmering under the surface for the last couple years. It began to boil over.
You know, it seemed like that whole part of the country was against the tribe for causing delays in the work schedules.
You could see it in the pages of the Billings Gazette, the largest newspaper in Montana. One letter to the editor read like this: "A people who a few generations ago were eating dog meat and sometimes killing their own girl children so they wouldn't have to go through so much grief. This same race of people can now go into a clean store and buy wholesome food, clean bedding, etc. Now they're getting so finicky they can't stand the thought of a few carbon particles or whatever being wafted in the wind."
It was overwhelmingly negative about the Cheyennes, you know, the prejudice about who we were and why, what right we had to stand up and question. You know, we turn the lights on and heat our homes and drive cars and everything, you know. But all we're asking is, you know, to do it with the best available technology and efficiently as we can.
The plant stayed closed for almost 3 years. Lawsuits flew back and forth between Colstrip's owners, the tribe, and the EPA. But Colstrip's owners weren't about to give up on their investment. They'd already sunk over $100 million. They added new pollution control machinery to the power plant and went back to the EPA and said, how about now? Here's the historian James Allison again.
The EPA says, okay, all right, we agree. You've done enough. You won't violate the Northern Cheyenne's downstream air. And they issue the permit.
And this is the crucial moment. The tribal council had the power company over a barrel because they could file another legal action against the EPA's approval and stall construction again. But the Cheyennes saw an opportunity. The council went to the company and said, is there some way we can work out a deal?
And the deal that the two sides work out is that Colstrip will get to operate, but they have to give the Northern Cheyenne jobs.
The tribe backed off in exchange for jobs. Jobs constructing and operating the power plant. The power company and the tribe hammered out an agreement. Northern Cheyennes got first hiring preference, meaning they'd be put on top of the pile, ahead of just about anyone else applying for the same job. A scholarship program was set up to send Cheyenne students to college for free, provided they study something related to energy development. And the man named to make it all happen? Dennis Limberhand.
They called it a liaison, kind of the middleman between a company and the tribe.
Dennis was in charge of all of the recruiting, helping tribal members prepare job applications, get ready for interviews, and anything else they needed.
That was really the first generation of lunch packers.
What Dennis means is that before the tribe's agreement with Montana Power, if you were living on the reservation and you wanted a career, good luck.
We didn't have a chance to get up and see our dads pack a lunch and go to work. Most of our fathers never had a job. Couldn't get a job. Nobody gave them a job.
And now that tribal members were getting jobs in Colstrip, some people there weren't happy about it. Every day Dennis went to work, he passed people in the parking lot or in the offices who saw him as the face of a program to steal their jobs.
Get in a fist fight if you want in a bar, I'll tell you that.
Linwood Tallbull was one of the first recruits. He remembers one of his first days.
And they put me in this crew, and they had a big Navy guy there. And they said, you take this guy, take this Indian out, show him how to work. Well, I haven't worked in half my life already. And he says, come on, Indian.
Linwood followed the Navy guy. They were moving dobies, these small concrete blocks with wire sticking out of them, made to hold rebar in place.
And he stacked a whole bunch on his arm. He was a big guy. And he says, I have 100. Don't get any less. I tried to get 100 on. I couldn't. But I seen a wheelbarrow. And I saw he walked off, and I peeked around a corner, and he's sitting there talking with these people, pointing at me every now and then. I put in 1,000 of them in that wheelbarrow. I went around the other way, and I dumped them where we were. And he was starting to cuss me out, and I says, I have my 1,000. Where are yours? They're always waiting for you to screw up.
Lynn once said when things were hard, especially in the beginning, he and the other Cheyennes would talk the whole bus ride home to the reservation.
We did a lot of healing coming in back and forth on a bus, and so we shared a lot. The job in Colstrip just made me see a broader range of my potential. That I could get a job anywhere in the United States if I wanted to work hard. And I think that's what it did, was build up that confidence in me.
The agreement caused strife on the reservation, too. After so many years of working against large-scale coal development, some tribal members didn't see the agreement as a good thing.
Some of our traditional people, they didn't like it at all, you know? Yeah, they didn't. Want anything to do with it, you know? And they voiced that. They expressed that to us, you know? There was opposition to it.
For you, was it hard to know what to do?
I got shot at from both sides, you know? I was full of bullet holes.
It's been 37 years since the tribe's agreement with Montana Power. Hundreds of Cheyenne men and women have worked at the plant or the mine, or gone to college through those scholarship programs Dennis helped to negotiate. Now their kids are working there. But still, half of families live below the poverty line, and their reservation has the highest unemployment rate in Montana. So the Northern Cheyenne's dilemma seems to remain. Putting it simply, do the Cheyennes mine their land to pull their people out of poverty, or preserve their land and cultural values and leave the coal in the ground? The Cheyenne have never stopped asking these questions, both in the halls of the Tribal Administration Building in Lame Deer and in the homes of tribal members across the reservation. Some, like Linwood Tallbull, say mine.
I think that coal development is a real must for our country.
The current tribal president, L. Jace Kilsback, wants to leave the coal in the ground.
We don't see the value in it. The little plot of land that the government left us, we're going to value it as much as we can for future generations.
It may not be up to the Cheyenne. Cheap natural gas is flooding the market and undercutting coal. The industry is suffering. And across southeastern Montana, everyone feels the effects, especially folks in Colstrip. They love where they live, too. Lori Shaw, the woman who we met at the beginning of this story, this is what she has to say about her backyard.
The plants out there are native species. In the fall, I get to see bucks fighting right outside my back door. And pheasants running along the street. It's so cool. And I'm going to stay as long as I possibly can, of course.
These days, people in Colstrip and on the reservation are in the same boat. They both love this place, and they're both uncertain of the future. Dennis says it's a problem for the next generation.
You know, I done the best I could, and I'll let someone else determine how good a job or how bad a job I done. Got some gray hair from it. Can't please everybody. What it comes down to is the economy and jobs, you know, versus the environment. Again, it's the same old battle. It's existed for how long? I don't know. Just kicked around like a football.
The tribal council's actions back in the 70s showed what the Cheyennes valued the most. Jobs were important. The land was important. But the ability to make their own decisions about how to protect their land and employ their people while preserving Cheyenne culture, that was the most important thing of all.
And I really look at what our ancestors did in the past and what they fought for. You know, we killed Custer. You know, we resisted the longest against assimilation. We fought the federal government, and that's not just in our history, it's in our DNA, it's in our blood.
This story was produced by me, Lacey Jane Roberts. The editor was Anna Sussman, with additional editing from Graylin Brashear, Chris Harlan Dunaway, Mary Lee Williams, and Levi Bridges. Special thanks to the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, Ben Manila, Claire Caulfield, and, of course, Dennis Limberhand.